Blog Talk Radio.
This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle stations.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everyone. I am your host, Sal, from the blog Commander Salamander, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One from Eagle Speak. And as a reminder for those that are with us live, make sure and join the chat room you can find over at the bottom of the show page. You should find the usual suspects there. And as we go along, if you have some observations or some questions, or you think we may have missed an angle with our guest, please fold into the chat room, and we will try to fold that into the conversation. Also, if you're new to Midrats and you'd like to catch up on the shows you may have missed, you can listen to the archives over on the show page at Blog Talk Radio, or you can subscribe and download the podcast via iTunes. Now, let's get on with the show. We have as our guest today two returning guests to talk about something that is an ongoing conversation and hopefully we'll be hearing more from coming down the road. As a mercantile republic surrounded mostly by water and relatively friendly neighbors, we've spent over a decade in basically a ground war in Asia. And this has got an extra challenge to us, and that we need to find a way to have a conversation to how to go forward. And with that, we have guest Mackenzie Eaglin, Research Fellow for National Security Studies from the Allison Center for Foreign Policy, and also Brian McGrath, Founding Director of Deltex Consulting. And you also catch him on the blog Conservative Wahoo. Mackenzie, Brian, welcome to Midrats.
Thank you.
Very good. And we had a little bit of a challenge. So we have a few other people dialing in. I think we still need to get Brian to call in, and we have got him back. So here is the opening question for everybody. In the backgrounder that the two of y'all worked on with as the Heritage Foundation had the title of Thinking About a Day Without Sea Power, Implications for U.S. Defense Policy. Why do we need to have this conversation now?
Well, I'll kick it off. Thanks for having us again. You know, the Secretary of Defense is on a very long goodbye farewell tour. I like to joke that he rivals Oprah in terms of trying to get his message out as he walks out the door. But the reason I bring it up is because we're literally at an inflection point. You know, Gates has been giving more speeches than anybody of late, and he's been saying all the things that people like me have been talking about for years, and it seems like there was this cognitive dissonance that the military has been living off the major capital invested 20 years ago by President Reagan. The equipment is increasingly old and worn down, and, you know, spending on new equipment and technology is still going to be required as defense budgets fall. And the challenge is going to be, you know, is Congress and the Pentagon and the Navy, and by extension the nation, are we just going to take a sledgehammer and hope for the best? Or are we actually going to sit down and have conversations about what is important to the nation, where falling dollars need to be invested, and where they may not going forward?
And Brian, are you back?
I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you great. Thank you.
Great.
I don't know how much you caught of Mackenzie's intro there. We're having a little bit of technical difficulties. But basically the question I asked was the piece that you worked on with her, thinking about the day without sea power implications for U.S. defense policy, is why right now do we need to have that conversation?
Because we are a country that tends to repeat its mistakes. We have experience with post-war drawdowns on several occasions since the end of World War II, and in each of those drawdowns we have cut the Navy an average of 33% in terms of real acquisition dollars, and about as much in terms of force levels. The problem is, though, that in each of those post-war drawdowns, the war was preceded or was closely attended by a dramatic build-up. This series of wars, which we are still in, though we are winding down from them, has been prosecuted over the course of the last 10 years. All the while, the Navy has lost about 20% of its force structure and about 20% of its people. This is while it was supporting those two wars. So I think we are likely to begin, and I see, and I see the signs around me, and McKenzie sees them and talks about them all the time, of an administration, a Secretary of Defense, and others who look to the Department of Defense to cut its budget, and the way they are most familiar with doing so is to just assign proportional shares to everybody, and everybody gets smaller. And I think that that would be ruinous to the Navy that we have and that we need.
One of the things I've done in the last year is I've done a fair bit of reading, trying to get myself caught up on the period of time right from the end of World War II to the opening of the Korean War. And one of the characteristics that took place is back then in the late 40s versions of the transformationalist group, where everything was going to be nuclear, when the Korean War kicked off, all aspects, Navy, air, and ground, tactically had withered on the vine, and specifically on the Navy, when the reality of what war is came back, there were literally fleets in reserve and in mothballs, and people who were in the reserves or had recently left the service that we could draw on to get back up on step. Is there an appreciation inside D.C. that the fact that that no longer exists? And to quote one of my favorite people, you go to war with the military you have, not that you wish you have, and we really don't have the reserves to feed off of. So as we bleed, there's nothing to pull back on. Is there an appreciation that things are very different in the second decade of the 21st century than it was when most of these people may have studied these issues in more detail?
Well, I can jump in first, and of course I want to hear from Brian, but I would say, not to be overly negative, but there's zero appreciation, Commander Salamander, because for 3 points. The first is what Brian raised, that there was no mobilization prior to Iraq, Afghanistan, and now Libya. Policymakers are just completely disconnected from all of these realities, and particularly ongoing operations and the defense budgets, and spending priorities. Two, there's also a serious lack of appreciation for basically the lack of surge capability that we have today, as well as that we aren't accounting for attrition any longer. So, for example, when you have almost no surge capacity in the fleet, Brian and I wrote about how every new casualty can ripple through the schedule of dozens of ships. We're seeing ship availabilities, for example, in some cases, maintenance, repair, and overhaul, not just first they are being delayed, then they're being canceled outright. Same thing happens when we're losing aircraft, for example, over the sky or on carrier decks. We have no attrition policy to have a buffer to add in additional force structure when we lose critical capabilities. And all three of these points are desperately lost on Washington.
I think I would only add to that that there is a dramatic lack of understanding of what exists in the Naval Reserve. The Air Force and the Army have a considerable amount of combat punch in the Air Guard and in the National Guard, and then a lot of supporting capability in the Air Reserve and the Army Reserve. Our reserves, incredibly important as they are, don't include much combat power. They include a lot of skills, a lot of medical, a lot of engineering, a lot of the things we need when we go to war and when we have to stay at war, but there isn't a lot of combat power there. So this gets to the question of surge that McKenzie just raised. We're out of Schlitz. When you have 50% of the fleet underway at any one time and a third of it forward deployed, what's left at home in Norfolk and San Diego is tired, It's not well trained, and there is, and it would take a little while for it to get up and go, but there's not a whole lot of it.
Eagle One.
One of the criticisms that I received.
Up, Eagle One. Looks like we've lost you down the pipe there. If you wanted to dial back in, let me kind of jump in while we reset with Eagle One. The when you read the foreign press in my RSS feed, I pull German, French, and mostly British to read on a regular basis. And we've seen since the beginning of the Libyan operation a new appreciation for the inherent flexibility and relative efficiency of having forces afloat to be able to project power, most notably the aircraft carrier. There's been a lot of mea culpas, especially on the British side, for what they've done with their Harriers and their flat tops. But you also see the French as well have really relearned the lessons that we try to talk about here. When you read the U.S. press, though, we really don't see that much. I mean, I think we've started a good conversation with what y'all have done at Heritage. But when you look in the people who discuss these larger national security issues, can you see some other people out there that are coming into the conversation and are trying to bring to the attention of our military establishment some of these same subjects? Brian, we'll throw it at you.
Okay. I think there are a lot of voices that are joining this fight. One that particularly interested me last week was that of Alan West, a freshman member from Florida, in remarks he did at McKenzie's own Heritage Foundation. This is an Army officer, a retired lieutenant colonel, and he stood there in front of that crowd and sung the praises of sea power, and interestingly, he sung the praises of sea power in opposition to land power. It's probably too simplistic a way to say it, but he was very clear that what the country needed going forward was more reliance on sea power and less reliance on land power. Is that a fair characterization, Mackenzie?
Mackenzie?
I'm sorry. It was quite a remarkable moment. I'm sure Brian would agree to see this career Army officer really believe in his heart the value and flexibility and benefits of preponderance sea power. It was an awesome moment. The speech can be viewed live online, it's archived online at heritage.org. And so, to Brian's point, yes, that's a very exciting and interesting change in dynamic where, you know, you see less parochialism by some sharp policymakers like Alan West of Florida. And the challenge here is that so much – I see a great divide – actually, I should call it a disconnect in Washington, however, about, you know, defense spending priorities and what's actually happening with all of the services around the world and everything that we're doing. And – you know, I hear members talk all the time about getting rid of waste as if, you know, there's a magic number in the tens of billions of dollars that can just be taken out of the defense budget, you know, without any consequence. And it's why we saw President Obama call for this roles and missions review as part of his deficit reduction plan for the military of upwards of possibly $300 to $400 billion over a decade. You know, it's not that simple. Members at least now recognize that they have to pretend like the military is going to stop doing something if they want to cut the budget pretty dramatically like we saw after the Cold War. The challenge here is that, like I said, in reality, I don't see anything changing. I don't see any president saying we're not going to send the Navy to Japan to help with disaster relief when it happens. You know, and I don't see any Joint Chiefs standing up and saying, sorry, we can't do that, but, you know, thanks for asking. So the challenge for me is that, you know, at least the conversation is sort of changing, but I'm not seeing any actions that are fundamentally different.
Eagle One, let's give you a shot again.
All right. Rebooting again.
I can hear you okay now. Then again, maybe not. Okay. Thanks for everybody's patience. Brian, you mentioned something earlier on that kind of touched on one of my pet topics I've been pondering about recently. Is you talked about there's a big danger here with a decreasing defense budget coming down the road that people are going to take the simple path and just do equal cuts of the pie. And a lot of this attitude, I think, derives from something that has outlived its usefulness, in my opinion, and that's Goldwater Nichols and this over almost religious feeling about joint and fairness, and we all need to speak with one voice and everybody takes an equal share. Is Goldwater Nichols something that, as old as it is still applicable in the second decade of the 21st century, or do we need to completely reboot how we structure, manage, equip, and resource our military?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've written quite a bit about this subject because it's one that gets my goat also. Goldwater Nichols and the jointness that it has brought has created an armed forces that is second to none in the world. Our ability to synchronize fires, our ability to bring the hurt from several different directions and several different servicing platforms is the envy of armed forces throughout the world. Jointness also offers some opportunities in acquisition, in helping the services to understand that you don't all have to have different kinds of widgets. If one widget is good enough for you, it's good enough for you, you should buy the same widget and enjoy the economies of scale that come from increased procurement numbers and lower unit costs. Where jointness is, I believe, damaging, not just detracts from, but it's damaging to things, is in strategic thinking, because what it does is it brings forward the sense that military power as a tool and an adjunct to national power must always be delivered in a proportional way in which the services are equally represented. And this, I think, is just a bankrupt vestige of Goldwater Nichols. Goldwater Nichols turns 25 this fall. If one of the Heritage Foundation's large donors is listening right now, I think they ought to pay Mackenzie lots of money to open up a study of Goldwater Nichols at 25, because I think there'd be some real ground to plow there in terms of getting to a point where the services can get back in the ring and can throw some punches, and you can get creative tension that
Absolutely.
You just don't get anymore. You just don't
Absolutely.
Get that anymore.
Yeah, can I jump in, Sal? You know, to Brian's point in your question, which I do think is great, I've seen the setback of the term jointness and joint-minded and all these phrases have become so common in Washington now, and a post 9/11 threat environment has really solidified what I think is also a sick or unhealthy idea amongst the services and its leadership, which is that, you know, and the core competencies and the individual attributes that make each military service superior are no longer important in this quote-unquote joint environment, when in fact that's exactly what makes the military superb at being joint. So I'm going to bring in my good friends over at the Air Force here for an example. You know, you can talk to any, you know, a lot of ground forces, whether that's Army soldiers or Marines, and you know, the Air Force is basically their ride along with the Navy to get there, you know, and to provide close air support and targeting and a couple other things. But, it, you know, we haven't seen sophisticated enemy air defenses in these kinds of fights, for example. So, you know, air superiority, who needs it? Even though, you know, that air superiority is the very thing that enables every operation, you know, to on the ground to succeed, whether that's because their network is working, because of the space and satellite assets they provide, or whatever. You know, the Air Force isn't just everyone's ride, but because, you know, the Air Force and the Navy in particular are so exceptional at what they do in providing sea and air power. Joint has become an excuse not to fund that or to, in fact, celebrate the service's superiority relative to everyone else.
Eagle One.
Well, can you hear me?
Still
now?
A little spotty, but give it a shot. All right, everybody hates dead time. Okay. Something that came out last week that I was on the Enterprise in the late 90s, and she was an old girl then, and she's still out there serving the taxpayers, doing great things, but she's definitely given her all and is ready to go home. And we saw last week the latest 30-year shipbuilding plan came out that, in my mind, has something that really comes on the edges of being dishonest to everybody in the national security, and that was saying that we're going to have the Blue Ridge, the Mount Whitney, our command ships, be afloat for 70 years, as opposed to doing what has been talked about for a long time. And they really proved their usefulness recently in both off Japan and also in the Med. Is there going to be a time that we really, from a shipbuilding perspective, have a more honest conversation? We've seen for years everybody talked about 313 when the numbers could never happen, and now we're talking about having these old steam plants go for 70 years. What have y'all heard on your end of discussions of this 30-year shipbuilding plan? Is it dead on arrival, or is it just something else that we can argue about? And we'll throw this over to McKinsey.
Well, I testified at that hearing where Congress examined the 30-year shipbuilding and aviation plans and their utility. And, you know, the Navy had a representative, of course, on the panel preceding mine. And, the good news is that I think the group as a collective, the Department of Defense representatives, members of Congress, and the outsiders like myself, agreed that long-term planning is absolutely essential, particularly for capital-intensive forces like the Navy and the Air Force. In fact, we can't live without it. And this includes everything from new procurement, but frankly, things like what is the retirement schedule for all of our assets? But then you have to take that a step further, because to understand the retirement schedule, you have to understand the maintenance schedule and where we're seeing a lot of, and what are the assumptions that underline all of these, build rates, one a year, two a year, when are we going to retire this, and when are we going to, bring this ship back home port? All of these things are interconnected, so it is difficult and to look at one piece of this without having all of the answers, in which that is an area where the plans are lacking, because there's no retirement data, for example, for some of the assets involved. The Navy was pretty quick to say that 30 years is ridiculous, but pretty much 20 years out is about right. And I actually think 30 is what we need to be looking out that far in advance, because of the mix of our legacy and new fleet on any given day. We're never going to have an all-new fleet. We're never going to have an only old fleet. For how long we are continuing to keep things in service, even though every time we build something, we pretend like we didn't just keep the last fighter in the air, 6,000 hours, or in some cases 10 or 12,000 hours longer than it was supposed to be, or a ship as well. So, there is this, and part of the reason we need to plan 30 years out is because it clarifies all of the problems and the pressure points today and over the next 5 and 10 years. And it's an opportunity to call out, for example, the Navy and say, wait a minute, you really think you're going to have, a shipbuilding account worth $15 billion, let's just say, in now dollars 10 years from now, and that you're going to be building the Ohio-class submarine replacement, and that's going to cost $7 billion, and you're going to do all of these other things? Are you kidding? It is an opportunity to call some reality checks on the services, but, in terms of actually putting out there a 70-year afloat plan, I think that's slightly off, and I think everybody recognized that immediately.
Yes, Sal. First of all, I don't think command ships serve a very useful purpose. I think if you're not delivering power in some way, you're just sort of, you know, taking up space. And there's almost nothing that happens on a command ship that can't be done from a shore-based command center, or a backup shore-based command center should that initial one get waxed, or on an aircraft carrier, which can handle the large majority of the job in case a command ship gets waxed. I think it makes our three-star admirals think that they're, you know, Star Wars characters, and having these great big wonderful command ships to go out and float around in. But we don't need them. I think the fact that there was a projection of a 70-year hull life for these things in the shipbuilding plans is an explication of just how fictitious the 21 to 30-year portions of those plans currently is. And I think two shipbuilding plans ago, the Navy basically said that, which is something along the lines of we have a high level of confidence in the first 10, we have a moderate level of confidence in the second 10, and we have little confidence in the third 10 years. I don't know exactly. I'm not an OR person, and I can't tell you with any sense of certainty that we get a lot out of the estimates that we put forward in for 21 to 30, the last decade. What I do know is that the Hill really gets their back up against the or at least they do so publicly sometimes, against the cost estimates. And Mackenzie and I touched on this in our piece, and I think she testified on this last week, in that there's no reason that CBO and N8 should estimate the costs of ships differently. They should use the same metric, and it should be one that they agree on, that discounts inflation the same, that looks at life cycle costs the same, that looks at fuel the same, so that when the Navy makes a projection of what shipbuilding will cost over the course of 30 years, the differences aren't as stark. And like the uncertainty of the shipbuilding plan increases as time goes on, the ridiculosity of the cost estimates gets wider and wider as time goes on. And until we get those basic accounting things down, the Hill will never believe the cost of a 30-year shipbuilding plan.
To what extent, if any, is the approach where we're continuing to diminish the size of the fleet and we have these other issues coming up, how much of that is partisan? How much of it is just there are so many competing money requirements, and how much of this is partisan? I noticed that, you know, in the USNI blog post I put up, one of the criticisms was your Weekly Standard article looked like you pinned some blame on the Obama administration with Mr. Panetta as the new Secretary of Defense. Was that intentional? Is that a result of just the fact that there are people in power right now?
Mackenzie?
We didn't. I'm sorry. I'll take this at first. Let's face it. Mackenzie writes for Heritage. They have a certain viewpoint. I am a blatant and ardent partisan political animal. Those things you got to take as a given. But if you look at the article itself, it's a thought piece. It's a think piece about a future and an alternative reality that could come. I slipped that line about Panetta in there specifically as a way to focus people's attention on the fact that we are going through a Secretary of Defense turnover right now. And if Mr. Panetta had an opportunity to read it, or one of his supplicants had an opportunity to read it, they might take notice of that and recognize that we have the opportunity to not make this mistake. That's why I put it there.
And I would just add to it that, no, on my end, no, none of this is political. I mean, I think a strong Navy that benefits the nation, it doesn't matter, you know, who you vote for in November. I mean, I just could care less. I really think these are sort of fundamentals that we have to get right. I think policymakers, you know, in fact, the irony is on the Hill, if I see any sort of coalescing around any sort of strong viewpoint, and when it comes to, you know, military strength, it is that the Navy, you know, has some of the greatest backing by policymakers as a group, which is fantastic. I think that's testament to having a good story and a good message, and frankly, just, you know, actions speaking louder than words in many cases. But, you know, Brian's right, a turnover does present a ripe opportunity to have all of these kinds of conversations or debates that people like us on this call like to always say that the nation needs to be doing. This is a window to do that, as opposed to just, you know, is Clinton's budget guy just coming in to sort of oversee the decline and the managed decline of the military, or is this actually going to be a conversation that we're going to have ahead of time? You know, and because Washington is very good at the former and not the latter. And, you know, it is about making and setting priorities and then sticking to them. And I've been critical for years. I've been in Heritage almost 5 years. I was incredibly critical of the Bush administration and a Republican-controlled Congress 3 years ago, 5 years ago, for all of these same reasons, continuing to defer modernization of the military, for example, in any sort of significant and meaningful way. You know, these, what I would say is underfunding the base budget while we've been, you know, relatively strong in terms of the war spending, but I think the service's peacetime budget, so to speak, has been dramatically underfunded. And so, and these are not popular things to say. And so I will criticize any president, Republican or Democratic, in any Congress, if I think that these are the wrong priorities, which they are.
Another thing, Eagle One, if I may, Congress gives the Navy every penny it asks for and more. I mean, if you look back over the last 15 or 20 years, if anything, budgets grow a little bit over there. They you know, people want to build ships. They want to put people to work. They recognize the amplified effect on the economy that a strong maritime industry has. We negotiate with ourselves in the Department of Defense. We get controls from OMB. OMB sends them to OSD. OSD sends them down to the services and says, this is your piece of the pie. Live with it. So if the Navy budget declines most of the time, or if it doesn't get what it needs, it's a result of an inside-the-building decision, rarely something that goes on in Congress. Congress likes to give us money to build ships.
Well, of course, that raises the question of how wisely we spend that money, and is there a level of congressional oversight where we can look at some overrun program? You know, we cancel various programs because of cost overruns, or at least somebody cancels. I'm not sure it's the Navy all the time. But is Congress, as budgets get tighter, are they going to put more constraints on how we spend our shipbuilding funding and all the other money that we ask for and get?
I see that as a possibility. You know, that was actually the underpinning of this 30-year shipbuilding hearing that I picked up on. You know, there was a tension in the room about, frankly, Congress's oversight role and responsibility, not just its, you know, sign the check and hand over the money, which everybody knows Congress's first job really is. But, you know, I consider oversight an equal priority of Congress, and one that I've witnessed the legislative branch of government almost give away entirely post 9/11. I see some small efforts to reclaim some of that, but look at Libya and the War Powers Act. And, you know, just the debate that's happening and the bills that are on the floor in the House just on Friday, actually. You know, the 30-year shipbuilding plan sort of helped symbolize and crystallize this push-pull with the executive branch, not just the White House, but the Department of Defense, in terms of what is, you know, Congress's ability to ask questions and get honest answers. And what I've seen, particularly under, you know, this Secretary of Defense, is none. You know, stay out, trust us, don't worry about it, everything's fine, and, you know, what we send over, don't amend it or change it, just give us the money. Brian's right in terms of political support is absolutely there to provide that funding, but, you know, I think strong oversight helps benefit everybody. And, you know, having a 30-year plan or a 20-year plan, whatever it is only a good thing for the services. Too often what I see is hostility hostility by the department when they're being asked to partner with Congress. And that is something that Brian and I talked about, that Congress and the Navy need a brand new relationship. They need their reset button, you know, going forward, because what we've been doing, I would argue, hasn't really been working. In terms of the dollars, yes, it's working, but the last 2 years have shown us that that's not going to hold up much longer, what Brian speaks of, this just unyielding political support. Because to your question, Eva, when the budget act falls, I mean, the knives come out, and for a good reason, because you have declining resources and everyone's become accustomed to certain things. But, you know, Congress has been asking the department to let us in, help us help you, and they continue to be given a cold shoulder. And so when you don't have them on your side, you know, keep your friends close here kind of thing, then they will go off and just make sometimes dumb decisions or bad decisions or ill-informed decisions that could hurt the Navy.
You know, Eagle One, Mackenzie and I made a recommendation in our paper that I think has some potential to help this question of how we spend our money. And specifically, I suppose that what you're getting at is cost overruns and acquisition programs, specifically shipbuilding. We advocate the creation of a four-star chief of naval material or chief of naval acquisition or something of that nature. Many of the great things the U.S. Navy has done have been done where there was an accountable officer, someone wearing the uniform whose job was on the line if the enterprise failed. The two that come to mind initially are Rickover and Wayne Meyer with Aegis. If you look at the shipbuilding chain of command, and you look at the guy we all look to in the Navy as the uniformed head thereof, I imagine if the CNO wanted someone fired, he could probably get them fired. But I don't see a direct chain of command within the uniforms. This, again, I think it's part of acquisition reform that flowed out of Goldwater Nichols. We've gone too far. This Chinese wall between requirements and acquisition has created a situation in which accountability has diminished. We believe that a four-star officer accountable to the CNO and the Secretary of the Navy and the acquisition authorities, with a term of office not unlike that of the Chief of Naval Reactors, 8 years in that case, probably similarly long in the Chief of Shipbuilding, would go a long way towards helping to reinstill Congress's sense that we can manage our own programs.
I think that's a great idea. Nothing's better than accountability. You know, I sometimes snarkily say I wish we held some of our flag officers to the same standard of professional conduct that we seem to hold our commander and captain commands, who get fired almost on a weekly basis. Another thing that you covered in your backgrounder I wanted to touch on, I kind of call it the Japan card, where if I was Japanese, I would do this. But the one thing that a Navy does with global reach is when people say America needs to show the flag, it's the fleet that shows the flag. When you have people on the other side of oceans or other side of continents who are looking for America, what they're talking about, if they're under this defense umbrella, most of it is a U.S. Navy. And with a smaller Navy and a smaller ability to create effects, good effects, before conflict even takes place, nations are going to change how they act and how they look after their own self-interest. And you brought up a really good point about countries such as Japan. If they perceive that that umbrella doesn't just have holes in it, but it doesn't cover them at all, or it's being folded up and taken away, that we could see a dramatic change in the global security structures. Could you touch on that for a bit?
Go ahead, Brian. I'll jump in after you.
Okay. Well, I mean, if you look at what's going on in East Asia, there is already a low level naval arms race underway. And you look at what the Malaysians are doing, the Singaporeans. Obviously, the Chinese are they're trading in numbers for capability. You know, the capability of the Chinese surface fleet, for instance, is increasing dramatically as they retire older, less capable ships. The Japanese are putting to sea an estimable missile defense force and more attack submarines, more submarines. What we stated in that piece in our view to the future was that, you know, our sense that if that in this future that we described, this horrific, you know, Thunderdome like future, the Japanese would simply execute plans to build nuclear weapons. And let's face it, building nuclear weapons isn't the technical challenge it once was. And the reason Japan doesn't build them now is because they feel safe from the umbrella of protection afforded by forward deployed, constantly ready American, predominantly American naval and air forces. Secretary Gates likes to talk about his trips to the Far East. I believe he's on one right now. He hears from those leaders every time he goes there doubts about our staying power. If you look at the Australian Defense White Paper that came out last year, they said it up front. They were very clear about it, that Australian defensive posture must get more forward-leaning because of doubts about American ability or desire to stay forward deployed and stay engaged in East Asia. So we think that's an important trend that we need to nip in the bud and nip it in the bud quickly.
And I would add, you know, it seems so obvious, and sometimes, you know, as we were chatting about before, you have to relearn history because the obvious just doesn't seem to click as these days in Washington. We've all heard the adage, quantity has a quality all of its own, and it's true. The fantastically intelligent Undersecretary of the Navy for Policy, Bob Work, often likes to talk about how today's fleet has the effects of a 400-ship Navy with battle networks and other types of precision capabilities and stealth, et cetera. And that may, in fact, very well be true. In fact, I would defer to him on that and say it probably is. But numbers matter because presence matters. One ship, one place, one time. That's all you can do, right? And so dropping to, say, a 200-ship Navy, because we have these incredibly, you know, capable technological things on board, is never going to work for the Navy for that exact reason. And just being in the neighborhood where these things are happening, it's no different with my own son. When I walk out of the room, they know it, and his behavior changes. They're mischievous. They're aggressive. They're looking around and doing things they're not supposed to do, right? And just the simple fact of me being in that room changes how my kid acts, and why would the world be any different? And so, yes, it's hard to, you know, disprove a negative in this case. Bad things didn't happen because we were there. So therefore, you know, the Navy, you know, give us more money or more ships. That is really hard to do. But I think we're actually starting to see some of the effects of this in places around the world, including South America and the Mediterranean, before we launched these Libya operations. You know, what happens when we're not there, or that we can't get there quickly?
Well, that raises the other side of the coin, though, which is if we, I mean, there is some financial limit, I assume, that our country can no longer afford to fund an extremely large Navy. And we've carried a lot of these nations, Australia and Japan and a number of others, with our presence for a long time. Isn't the other side of the coin is that it's about time some of these people, nations, stood up on their own legs, provided for their own defense, and that we can not necessarily, you know, there's some level to which we can reduce our commitment to some of these patrolling some of these areas and let our allies do it. I mean, wasn't that one of the goals of the 1,000-ship Navy?
No, it was never one of the goals of the 1,000-ship Navy. It was never one of the goals of the 1,000-ship Navy to walk away from responsibility. It was, however, to try to incentivize shared responsibility. So the suggestion that what we were trying to do was to create a situation where our presence wouldn't be necessary, especially in some place like as strategically important as East Asia. That's just off the mark. We'd like to see East Asians do more, certainly. My own personal view is that we want them to do more because we want to show the Chinese that our partnership is strong, vibrant, ready, and able. But at the end of the day, as far as I'm concerned, if you want to be the world leader, if you want to lead the free world, if you want to disproportionately benefit from the global system, then you got to be prepared to bear that burden and that responsibility. And 4% of GDP doesn't strike me as being too high a price to pay. The defense budget isn't what has bankrupted this country. And so looking to the defense budget to unscrew it is, I think, off the mark.
To your question, yes, every sort of defense program and priority should stand alone on its merit, and if not, you can get rid of it. You know, that's a very simplistic way of saying it. That's true. I think, economically we've shown we can sustain about what we're spending right now on the defense budget and probably even slightly more without causing any undue harm or economic distress. But, sure, would it be great if our allies did more? Absolutely. This is something I hear about all the time in Washington. But this is something you and I and your listeners have spoken about before, because two things have to happen. Actually, I should say three. First is they actually need to do more. So, you can walk away and hope for the best, but then if it doesn't happen and you have to return or return in greater number, have you really saved any money or effort as a result of that? I don't know. Two, what we've seen, Bob Gates himself, the Secretary of Defense, has said, in fact, when the U.S. diminishes its presence in certain areas around the world in the hopes that our friends and allies will do more, the burden on America actually grows. That's what happens on the ground, so to speak, or in reality, that he has seen. And then the third point is just you can't outsource leadership. You've got to be there if you need to be there. It's, our friends are never going to have our interests. Our friends aren't exceptional the way that we are. And in fact, it's just always going to be a different calculus when you have, a U.S. Navy commander as opposed to somebody else there with eyes on the prize, so to speak, deciding things. Do I believe it's a fair time as part of this larger defense debate, particularly as the presidential election for 2012 really gets underway, which it's starting to right now in Washington? Do I think the time for, how are we spending all of our tax dollars, and is that the right thing to do? Sure. Absolutely. And what is the role of defense as part of that? Absolutely. One of the things Brian and I try to do in this effort, we got to be scaremongers or create this crazy sounding scenario and then talk about all the benefits of sea power. But actually, in one part of it was, in my mind, to make a connection to the average American, we'll call myself that. Unfortunately, I live inside a boat and I have for too long, though. So we'll talk about my parents in Atlanta, Georgia. And what does the U.S. Navy provide to them on any given day? A landlocked state. Actually, Georgia has some great coastline, but pretend they lived in a landlocked state. They don't have a kid floating on a ship overseas right now. So in their minds, they don't make the connection, I would argue. I hope they don't yell at me. That, by going to Walmart or to Target and finding everything that they want on the shelves at a very low price is because the Navy has allowed the free flow of goods and commerce around the world to log on and to check their email on their fancy smartphone is also partly because the Navy protects the sea lines of communication and a lot of the cyber capabilities along with the Air Force. These types of things, the military's strength actually protects and bolsters our economic might as a nation. And if we lose sight of that and just start cutting defense and hoping that the economy can continue to prosper, aside from this recent, recession, then we've hurt ourselves doubly, because then we've weakened our physical security and our national security, and we're going to also, by extension, then weaken our economic security. They're mutually reinforcing.
And I'll blindside Brian and throw this at him, because I know that down the hall from McKenzie, she's got lots of people spend a lot of time on this, but the economists like to talk about the BRIC countries. You see, in the last really 18 months, it's almost become a buzzword: Brazil, India, Russia, and China. And you know, on the Navy side of the house, national security, we'll talk about China and Russia a lot and their implications, both short term and long term. But not often do we talk about the rising economies of Brazil and India, which, unlike China and Russia, they are representative republics, and they are increasing their military strength. Where do you see in this long-term view what we might be able to gain from a larger national security point of view with relationships with Brazil and India, and how do you see where that relationship is right now, and if it's going in a direction you think might be in a good one?
Yeah, I just actually was at a conference earlier this week on the U.S.-Indian relationship sponsored by the Lexington Institute, and it was fascinating. And it's fascinating in that there were the defense attaché was there, a brigadier general and a retired brigadier general for their Center for Land Warfare, and what I heard in the room was exactly what I've heard in the press and seen in the press. India has a very, very proud sense of non-alignment. India has some strategic objectives that are closely aligned with ours. I think President Bush and his reaching out for them on the question of nuclear issues went a long way towards alleviating some of the mistrust that had built up over the decades and over our perception of their coziness with the Soviets during the Cold War. But India is a nation that sees itself as a pole in this multipolar system. If we are going to have a strategically important relationship with India, I think we are going to have to understand that it will be a relationship of equals or near equals. We're very good at leading clubs, leading alliances. We're not as good. We don't have as much experience in mutually beneficial partnerships. That's what I think we're probably going to have to pursue with India in order to have you look at just the geography, India, Australia, Japan, you get good relationships with those three nations. You've got a pretty good maritime perimeter if what you're looking to do is to manage China, and I use that phrase guardedly. Brazil, on the other hand, I don't know about Brazil yet. I know that they've got some naval capability. I think they have an aircraft carrier, actually. They've got their own source of petroleum or not petroleum, but sugarcane, ethanol, that they can power virtually anything they need with it. I think they, at this point, are looking to be treated more seriously as the South American version of the United States in terms of power. And I think they're a little too cozy with Venezuela sometimes, but I don't see them yet as in India's as strategically important as India is. But they may be economically important. I think McKenzie might have some smarter things to say on this than I.
No. Well said, Brian. I would add one sort of generic and general point, but important nonetheless, which is, you know, we recently had General Fraser, Commander U.S. Southern Command at the Heritage Foundation, an event that can also be watched online at heritage.org, and it was just this truly outstanding eye-opener, slightly scary honest conversation that he was trying to have with Washington, basically saying everyone's taking their eye off the ball because, we have an establishment and a bureaucracy focused on counterinsurgency. Argue whether or not you think that is absolutely the right thing. Most people say it's generally a good thing. To win the war that we're in, to not win them would be a horrible thing. So I do tend to agree with that. However, the military every single day, as we've seen with Japan and Haiti and Libya and everything else, has to walk and chew gum at the same time. They have to constantly be worried about the future, and I mean the 20-year future. We have to be worried about, you know, our relationship with our friends and our allies, and we have to watch for emerging challenges and you know, sort of the next problem, the next threat, the next war. And South America is just an area of the world that is connected. There is no area in the globalized world that we live in, you know, that is untouched by our interest any longer. We used to be able to kind of ignore South America, Africa, and other areas too, but none of this is the case anymore. The organized crime, the criminal connections to, you know, the drug war and the funding and then where that goes to help fund terrorism, you know, Venezuela helping create a potential Cuban missile crisis redux at this time in Venezuela with the hosting of Iranian missiles. I mean, we are just seeing the opening of the Panama Canal, the Arctic ice melting and opening up again another new route. I mean, all of these types of major shifts in the landscape are happening, and South America is just a critical block that affects our security interests and our daily lives, and we've had to unfortunately overlook a lot of this for the past 10 years. But it's high time again right now to start thinking about these places of the world, often forgotten. Brazil is one.
Well, that you know, you've given a pretty good list of some areas of concern. If you were to have the ability to speak directly to the American public in something other than a Weekly Standard article or in the Heritage Society, and you were going to, you know, tell them, look, we need Navy, a larger Navy or a Navy at least the size we have now, what 4 points would you make as to what are the biggest areas of concern that we should, that needs to address?
All right, I don't know if I could do four, but I can get it started. The first would be that we are an exceptional nation, and part of what makes us exceptional is that we have worldwide interests. In order for those worldwide interests to be adequately protected, we need a strong Navy and Marine Corps to be out and about looking after those interests. Number two, I would say that while the threat of global thermonuclear war has dramatically lessened, it is not gone, and the Navy's ballistic missile submarine force is out and about every day providing the nation with its most effective, most survivable brand of nuclear deterrence. You got two, Mackenzie?
Sure. You know, military superiority or dominance or whatever phrase you want to talk about, it's not a birthright. Just because we've had it for virtually as long as anyone can remember, particularly, you know, post-World War II, doesn't mean that it just continues to exist without a conversation about discussion and spending priorities and without thoughtful investment. I would highlight the fact that the QDR independent panel said, has warned the American people to say, a train wreck is coming for the military, if something isn't reversed in terms of our modernization priorities, and that includes maintaining at a minimum the spending on that particular capability that we have today. As I had opened up the beginning of this conversation, you know, President Reagan is just a name in the history books to a lot of young people today, and there, you know, we're losing the memory of the buildup and what it meant for all of the benefits and successes of our military today, whether that's, you know, Saddam Hussein as a speed bump, or, you know, being able to respond to Libya and Japan while supporting, you know, the transit and help for U.S. forces in Afghanistan. Literally, there is no other harder place on Earth where you can launch an operation except possibly Antarctica, in terms of that country. So, you know, these are fleeting. The contract that America has always had, at least recent history with its military, that, you know, our service members won't be in a fair fight, is going away. And if we're going to do that, we need to be honest about it, as opposed to react after it's been given away and something goes really wrong.
And we're just about out of time. And for all our listeners, if you wanted to see a little more detail of what we were talking about, if you head on over to the Heritage Foundation, or you can just do a Google search for McKenzie and Brian's name, Thinking About a Day Without Sea Power, Implications for Defense Policy. And, of course, Brian, you can also catch him over at his blog, Conservative Wahoo. And McKenzie and Brian, thank you very much this Sunday for coming on MidRats. It's been a great conversation.
Thanks for everything. We appreciate it.
Thanks, everybody who is joining us live and those of the Gilson Archive. And join us again next week. Hope you have a great Navy Day.
The strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know.
Goodbye, Piccadilly.